I understand you did the golden calf last week, so it was a little bit different in the actual order of things, because it's normally, it would have been this, what we're going to learn about today, then the golden calf, but in the nature of the difference in services, we thought it might be nicer for the kids to do the golden calf rather than the Ten Commandments, although you're going to teach them later on today about the Ten Commandments, so it doesn't matter anyway. But just so in your head, you can work out the order, it's the golden calf comes after today, but It doesn't really matter. It's going to be a slightly different today in that I want to do like a whistle-stop tour up to the point around the Ten Commandments. And then rather than do a talk on the Ten Commandments and one, two, three, four, which you kind of get anyway, I want to read quite a large section of Scripture which covers this entire area. And I kind of want to just let God do what he wants to do with it. I think the Ten Commandments is one of those things which is old as anything. Even if you're non-Christians, they know about the Ten Commandments or they've heard about the Ten Commandments. They might not know all of them. You know, I doubt we could list off all ten from memory. But the idea of the Ten Commandments is kind of known. So I felt very strong. I didn't want to do just a very cheap talk on, well, one is this, two is this, three. Because that will happen anyway. But I want to just kind of give you actually the whole backstory of what God is doing in that moment. But when they come out. But just to kind of lead up to the point, there's a couple of bits in the story I want to just briefly talk about, just so in your head you go, oh yeah, I can remember that story. This is where it fits in. So very, very early on in the wilderness kind of journey, we have this kind of battle that Israelites kind of go through. Does anyone remember the story of Moses and his hands lifting up? And yeah, this is when it happens. So really, really early on, we're probably talking the first week or two, if that, of them actually, they get attacked, and I read this, I think it's the Amaleks, that's the one, that's what I meant to say, they get attacked, and basically somehow they work out, Moses basically goes up onto a hill to pray, and somehow they work out that when Moses is doing this, the Israelites are winning, and when he gets tired, because you can't hold your arms up forever, when he gets tired, the Israelites start losing. Don't ask me how they worked that out. But they managed to work out that this is the kind of the correlation. So in the end, they get a couple of young guys to basically hold his arms up. So there's Moses just kind of sat on a hill, and these two guys are kind of propping his arms up. And for some reason, God is using it, and the Israelites are winning. Really strange story. I don't even want to teach on it or talk on it. All I have to say is that's when it happens. So when you, in your head, you go, oh, there's a story about Moses with his hands in the air. This is where it is. Okay. Then we move on. Then we get to Jethro. You know who this guy is? Father-in-law to Moses. So he basically sends word to Moses and said, right, I'm going to come out and meet you, and I'm going to bring your wife, my daughter, and your children. We're going to come out and meet you in the wilderness. And he comes out and he meets him in the wilderness, and Moses kind of greets him, and they get on very well, which is quite nice. You know, you hear sometimes stories of in-laws that don't get on particularly well. They actually get on very, very well. And he kind of invites him into the tent. And we don't know how long he actually stays with him, but there's one particular day that is kind of recorded that Jethro sees how Moses does business, essentially. Now, this is a really interesting, for me, it's a very interesting kind of event, because we always assume that Moses is a really great leader, don't we? He's the man everyone talks about, Moses, when actually he didn't want it. He really didn't want it. God said, go and do this. He's like, no, I don't want it. I can't speak. I don't want to actually go and do this. So we assume that all of a sudden he's top class, A-listing kind of leader that knows how to lead a massive group of people. And actually, he's learning this as he goes, which actually gives me quite a lot of hope as well. But he's learning it as he goes. And what Jethro discovers is because the people, they're beginning to get into this kind of sense of learning how to actually operate as a people. Because if you remember previously this, they've been slaves. They've never had to think about how to operate as a society. They just, you know, say yes, sir, no, sir, or whatever. So now they're starting to learn this. Jethro finds that Moses sits in a tent all day from morning to evening. And all day long, people come in and they tell them their quarrels. They've got this problem. So-and-so stole this sheep and they're grazing on this, you know. And Moses basically just goes, oh, yeah, right, do this. Don't do this. And all day long, he's like an agony aunt, right? He's just going through and saying yes to this, no to this. And Jethro's response, I think, is lovely. Because he's the first person that actually shows a real genuine care and an interest into Moses as a person. You find this really strangely, okay, in some, and I haven't found it here, which has been lovely, but you find it sometimes in how people talk towards the person who speaks or the person who kind of, who leads. There's this weird kind of like, we don't know how to treat you. We don't know how to like, we can't really joke with you because you're the person that teaches us. We can't really be friends with you. And it's a really weird relationship you find sometimes. Actually, some leaders, they really struggle making friends in ministry. Because they're not, there's that weird kind of like, oh, you're the person that's up the front and you tell us, you know, what God is saying here and there. We don't really know how to relate to that. And I should imagine this is probably what Moses is going through. Imagine this, he rocks up into Egypt and God, through Moses, used him. And he does these ridiculous, incredible miracles, you know. To this point, he's split the Red Sea, he's shook a rock with his staff and water's gushed out. There's going to be a sense of like, kind of fear and awe around Moses, like, I kind of don't want to get too close to you because you might hit me with that magic stick of yours that's going to do something weird. So I don't really know, right? So no one actually really takes the time to say, Moses, how's it going? Moses, are you actually doing okay in this? You know, he's just led these people out into the wilderness and he's just, you know, he's learning as he goes and no one's really kind of backing him up here. He's the only one kind of doing it. In comes Joe. This is the first bit we're going to read and it's Exodus 18. It's just really good sound advice. If I could meet anyone from history, first person would be Jesus, second person would be Moses, and the third person would be Jethro, believe it or not. Just mainly from this kind of piece here. Okay, it's 18:17. Moses, Pharaoh's son, said to him, "What you are doing is not good. You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out. For the thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to do it alone. Now, obey my voice. I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their causes to God. And you shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them known the way in which you must walk and what you must do. Moreover, look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens." That is so practical. Such practical advice. Here's Moses sitting all day long, getting worn out by pastoral issues, essentially. Quabbles and dealing with these little niggly bits that doesn't really have to, you know, but need doing. Someone has to do them. And he really feels the burden with all of it. Jethro comes in and goes, "Yeah, you're looking pretty knackered. Do you know what? I love people that can look at me and go, something's not quite right. What's going on?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm not feeling particularly well." "Oh, do you need to take some time off?" Right? Above all, do you know what? I really appreciate someone coming in and say, "Oh, actually, you look quite tired, or you look this. You shouldn't be up here, should you, mate?" "Hello. Oh, back you go." You're not going to do it. But it's a really, really practical advice. And I love this idea of they kind of block out to thousands, to hundreds, to fifties, of tens. In this moment, Jethro actually teaches Moses plurality of leadership. You've got something like 2 million people and then one person. Can you imagine the amount of, well, a lot of pastoral issues that come out are rubbish, let's be honest. There's, someone did this, and you're like, okay, right, well, you know, some of them are actually quite serious, but some of them are just little niggles. But 2 million people and one person. Everything's got to go through this one person. That's not going to happen. I love that it comes so early on, because I think if this would have gone on too much longer, I think Moses probably would have burnt out, which is actually what you see in a lot of leaders today. They don't work out how to build team around them. So Moses says, okay, I need to get guys who I trust, who are honorable, who hate a bribe, who are God-fearing, and I'm going to put them in charge in thousands, depending on their ability and anointing, in charge of 1,000, hundreds, fifties, of tens. And he teaches a plurality of leadership. This church has a plurality, I keep getting the word wrong, but you know what I mean, of leadership. Because if it was just one, not only would that one burn out, but you only get one aspect. You only get that one little, whatever their gifting is. And we've been talking about this, and I'm not going to go into trustees and firefold, because I think we've talked about it a lot. But this is part of the reason. You get a much wider, stronger leadership from plurality. So this is why I quite like this dude, Jethro. Okay, we'll move on to the main event. Mount Sinai. God leads them to Mount Sinai. And let me ask you this question. Why did God lead his people out of Egypt? Why did God actually ever bring his people out of Egypt? Go to the promised land.
Worship him.
Out of slavery. Any others?
Called out to him.
Yeah. So there's an idea that there's a promised land that he's heard his people's cry. I mean, I've heard when people cry. So I'm calling. The biggest reason that he actually brings them out of slavery is because the father is desperately just wanting to be with his children. Desperately, finally wants to be with his children. And this goes right back to Genesis in the garden, how they walked in the cool of the day and God was with man and woman, Adam and Eve, and they walked in this beautiful relationship, and then the sin comes in. And it's this ripping apart, this kind of divorcing between father and children. And they go separate ways. And up to this point, it's been this real struggle of how can God finally kind of somehow get back to some level of being with his children, even though now sin is in the way. We're still a long way from the cross, right? And when the cross comes in, that sin thing gets dealt with, and we can finally get back to how it was always meant to be. But at this point, God is working out, how can I actually be among my people, yet with this sin thing still in play? Because it has to be dealt with at the cross. But God doesn't want to wait until the cross before we can actually start being with his children. So how does he ever going to actually come and be among his people and be the father to his children where, yeah, he can't be around sin? You know, I talk about it like being oil and water, that you cannot mix them. There's this glory and magnitude of God. He just cannot be around sin. One has to go, and it isn't God's. That's why you find these really strange, when we get into the law in other weeks, you find these really obscure things of how you kind of have to try and clean yourself up and sanctify yourself and make yourself righteous before you come in to God. You ever heard of the story of Aaron's two sons? So, I mean, this is going on a bit, but Aaron becomes the high priest when we get to the tabernacle and all that sort of thing. And his two sons, they don't follow how to the washing rituals. They don't follow it to the T. Okay, and they think they're just going to barge into the Holy of Holies, they die instantly. This is a kind of, God cannot be around sin. That's why there's so much of this weird, clean yourself up, wash this, don't touch anything. There's so much of that because God is trying to be among his people with this sin thing still intact. Okay, and this is his kind of step one into being it, Mount Sinai. And what I'm going to do is I'm literally going to read almost a couple of chapters of this. And I wanted just to kind of for you to really get into the magnitude of what's going on here. This whole build up, okay? It's going to be on the screen, but for you, you might think, you know what, I don't actually want to read it. I just want to be read and let it kind of come over you, okay? Because actually, for me, this is not just about the Ten Commandments. There's something in this about the fear of God that takes hold. All of a sudden, people understand the size and the magnitude of God's, and it has a particular effect on people, okay? And what I want, I feel like what I was, as I was prepping for this and praying for this, I feel like our view of God is always far too small. It's always far too small. And I think it's quite funny how we talk to God sometimes. And I've even taught this, you know, oh yeah, have a go at God, he can take it. And hang on a minute, who are you talking to? The God who made the universe. The only reason why you're taking that next breath is because he permissions it. And yet we cheapen it by having a go at him or not doing what he says. And this is all grace that we are actually allowed to be present in God's presence whilst being arrogant and whilst mouthing off. And he told me to do this last week and I still haven't done it, but, you know, and God still shows up. That's grace, nothing but grace. And we don't appreciate the cost involved in that. So I want to just kind of read this. And it's always good sometimes just to, I don't normally do this, I normally just have a couple of verses, but it's good sometimes to just kind of delve in a bit. So if you want, just let this kind of wash over you almost. But I'm going to be reading from Exodus 19, verse 10, and I'll read for a while. Already up to this point, there's been this sense that God has called Moses up to the mountain. And they have this weird relationship where God goes up to the mountain for a little while, comes back, tells the people something, goes up to the mountain for a little while, comes and tells the people something. So this is, they're kind of getting used to this weird exchange. Verse 10. The Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set limits for the people all around, saying, take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, there shall come up to the mountain. So they're allowed to come to the mountain, but not actually onto the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people. And they washed their garments. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day, but do not go near a woman. That's just thrown in there. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet their gods. What a moment. And they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in the thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called to Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And then the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to the mountain, Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. And the Lord said to him, go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. This is where the Ten Commandments come in. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the lands that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us, and we shall listen. But do not let God speak to us, lest we die. Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin. The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. There is so much going on there. I love it how they say, you speak to us and we will listen. Because they never do with Moses. He speaks a lot and they never listen. But there is so much of the character of God in that that we don't like to talk about. And this sometimes it's not my job to defend God, to try and wrap God up in a nice cotton-filled way so we can, oh yeah, God's really easy for me to understand. Do you know, there's bits of this Bible that I don't get. There's bits of the character of God that I read and I'm like, because isn't he so much bigger than me, right? So when we read scripture, we read who God is, we're kind of like, how am I even supposed to comprehend that? I could try and use words to describe, but isn't how cheap that is to say, oh, God is big. Come on. And sometimes we just have to get a bit like that and just let it go in. Just kind of like, who cares what I think what God is and who cares what you think God is? The Bible tells us. And sometimes we just need to read it as a whole from start to finish. Yeah, it's going to take you a while. But read it as a whole and think, okay, God, you've revealed yourself to me in this. Who are you? And let God begin to speak to you out of that. Don't go, all right, you tell me who God is, because they'll give you what it is to them. God tells you what he's like. And that's what I wanted just to kind of read that, because there's so much in that of the magnitude of God's, that he finally descends on this mountain, right? God, the size of who he is, we can't even get a head around, decides in one moment to descend on one planet that he's made, on one mountain. Of course, that mountain is going to be shaking. Cannot contain the presence of God. And then he goes, Moses, come on up. He's a brave boy. And up he goes up the mountain like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And then he says, oh, it's all right, guys, don't be afraid. Come on up, come and meet your God. And they're like, ah, no way. Because they're so terrified. Is this also like when Isaiah sees the Lord in his vision? And he's sort of like, he sees the Lord sitting on a throne. And the train of his robe fills the temple. And the whole place is shaking. And basically Isaiah's words are, woe is me. Which is, oh, I'm going to die. Because all of a sudden I've seen God. And so far, anyone who sees God dies. So Isaiah's like, yep, I'm going to die. And then an angel comes and anoints his lips. Because Isaiah is so overtaken by his shortcomings. He knows, do you know, I'm such a sinful man. And yet all of a sudden I'm being brought into the righteousness, this presence, this righteousness presence. And it can't hold both. So Isaiah's like, yeah, I'm going to die. Don't ask me why Moses thought, you know, yeah, I'm. He was straight up there, like anything. He is brave to kind of draw near. I love that very end. How it just finished, what I said there, you know, the people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was. We have such a privilege when we come into the presence of God. We have such a privilege. When God decides to show up, even though we are wretched without Jesus, we are wretched without Jesus. And yet, out of his grace, he goes, you know, I just want to be with my kids this morning. And he's here among us. And we just get to sit, we get to laugh, we get to play with God. We don't realize the privilege. That we don't realize the cost. And I purposely didn't want to do too much on this. We're going to watch a video of the Ten Commandments. Like I said, a cheesy video, which will kind of make it get stuck in your minds. And then I want to just do a little bit off the back of it about just the fear of God and just kind of let God do what he wants to do with us this morning. So if the video is ready to go, like I said, you can laugh at this. Please laugh at this. Ridiculous. I came across that, I thought I have to show it. It's too good. The first couple was like, actually, they kind of make sense, you know. And then I think it gets to number four, and I'm thinking, And then like number seven, I'm like, no, come on, you just can't just throw numbers in any old where. But it will, believe it or not, it will make you remember. So, number one, anyone? Got it, yeah, God is number one. Number two? Yeah, because it was in the shape of someone bound down. Number three? Yeah. We haven't quite got that one yet. Lips? Basically, do not take the Lord's name in vain, yeah? Look at those big red lips taking the Lord's name in vain. Number four? The Sabbath is upon us. You must not watch the telly, thy telly, yeah? No, don't ask me how that fits in, but kind of, there's a boy watching the telly. Of course, it's a Sunday or Sabbath. You know, keep that day special. Keep the, you know, honor the Sabbath day. Number five? Yeah, all of a sudden the parents are like contortionists. They morph themselves. Honor mother and father. Number six? Yeah, all of a sudden someone throws a really old-fashioned bomb. A comedy bombing in, yeah, do not murder. Number seven, yeah, when the heart breaks, it breaks with a lovely, clear number seven in, of course. Do not commit adultery. Number eight, yeah, it's the mask, yeah. So that was quite good. Number nine, do not lie, because the number nine just lied down. I mean, it just, you can't get much better than that, right? Number ten, do not covet, because the one was the door, and the zero was a ring. Okay, just mad, but believe it or not, that will help you remember. Even if you go, oh, number three was lips. Why was it? What was lips? And then eventually it will come. It will help you remember. So, when the kids come back in and they ask you about it, then you know. Right. The Ten Commandments is, they've, any society that's ever come out from this moment have never been able to improve on the Ten Commandments. It's one of those things that God kind of downloads to his people that is so fundamental, but if you go to any culture that has never heard God or the gospel preached or anything like that, they've gone out to like remote tribes in the middle of the jungle, and they kind of, they eventually, you know, they live there for like 34 years, they begin to learn the language, they ask them, how do you operate, what is not okay? There's scarily quite close similarities. Most people understand that killing someone is wrong, right, or stealing someone's wife is wrong. And they find actually a lot of these stuff, everyone's like, actually, yeah, we would all agree with. Actually, in creating a society, you need to have some basic things which are okay and which are not okay. And this is the first time as a people group, you know, we talk about the Ten Commandments. There was hundreds and hundreds of commandments that was given. You know, after this moment, I think they worked out there's about 52 others that fill out just these 10. And then I think there's a few hundreds that are all about washing rituals and what you can do at certain times of the year. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. There's so many laws that are out there, you could never live up to them. Right? This is the point of the law. It comes out, the standard that it sets is so high that only God can meet. Right? Do we get this? So in it comes to this early kind of people group. And we talked, I think the last time I spoke about, we talked about the use of woods and how there's a lot of woods so far in the story. And the lesson actually is your salvation comes from something that is made of woods, right? And how everything is building up to Jesus and the cross. And then we get these Ten Commandments. And on the face of it, we're kind of going, actually, we reckon we could probably do our best in living up to that, right? I mean, not many of us think, oh yeah, I'm going to go out and kill loads of people. I'm going to go, right? We can generally get heads around the 10, but then when you start to get into the hundreds and the hundreds of them, you realize that it's such a high bar to meet. And of course, these guys, they never meet it. The whole idea is to point to our eyes, you cannot save yourself. By law's standards, you will always fail. By you trying to improve yourself to a standard which is acceptable to God, does not happen. You need someone, God's, to do it for you. The only one who can meet God's standards is God himself. And this whole idea is it's building up to Jesus and the cross. So first of all, take it easy, right? Because we put so much guilt on ourselves. And I'm not saying, oh yeah, just go away and sin. Oh, that's great, yeah, off you go. I'm not saying that at all. But sometimes we put such strict kind of boundaries upon ourselves and think, okay, right, the law is this. I must please God. So and actually, I don't think it was ever meant to be that way. I think this is in here to show us that actually you cannot save yourself, that you need a saviour, and that is Jesus. And you know what? There's times in my life where I've got to the point where I feel so guilty. Like, so guilty, I can't leave the house. How can I go out and teach? How can I go out and do this? Because look what I've done. Satan loves it, right? He loves the guilt game. We mess up. It's wrong. We know that, right? I'm not permissioning it or saying, oh, yeah, go ahead and do it. But Satan uses it and go, oh, yeah, how bad are you doing it? And he traps in. And you know, in those moments, how I go over it is I rest further and further into the cross. I begin to rest further and further into the person who Jesus is and what he says about me. When Satan comes in and says, oh, yeah, well, look at you, and this happens and this happens, and who are you to say? I say, hang on a minute. On this side of the cross here, Jesus has dealt with all that. He's done with all that. So yes, it was wrong. I'm forgiven. Lord, forgive me. I'm forgiven. And I can get past this guilt game. Satan loves to use this. And one of the things I want to say to you guys is I want to free you from guilt. Because it's one of the biggest stifling factors on the church today. How can we be a group of people that are supposed to lead the world in ways of righteousness and how to live life and how to live godly marriages and how to bring up godly children? How can we be a people that are supposed to set a standing living across all things, how to manage our finances and everything like that when we get it wrong so often? How could I ever teach? That was one of the biggest battles that I had to go through when I was about late teens. How on earth can I ever, when God began to start speaking to me about what I felt I was going to be doing, which I am doing at the moment, right? And God began to, I was like, there's no way, God, I could do that because of. How could I ever do that? Because I'm like this. And I had to go on a healing journey with that, and God had to release me from guilt in that and get me to that understanding that actually, no, Jesus dealt with this on the cross. And all I need to say is, I'm sorry, and I accept your forgiveness. Let's move on. Satan loses that power over you. So first of all, I want to try and release the power that Satan has over some of us this morning, just from the guilt game. Okay? The second thing what we're going to be doing is, it's in kind of a response time, but the reason why I wanted to read that out in a whole, as a whole like that, is because I wanted to kind of let the person of God just kind of be present. I didn't want to say one little verse out of context, God is like, okay? I just wanted to kind of read it and just kind of let God do what God wants to do. And we saw what happens when God decides to step into a room, when the thickness comes and the presence. And if any of you have ever walked into a room where the presence of God is so thick, you can feel the atmosphere, right? You walk in, you're like, there's something charged here. You can feel the thickness, okay? When you walk, first of all, you have to be so thankful for the privilege that you're allowed to step into that environment, okay? But there's an amazing place to be. And what I want to do is we're going to have just some response time. There's going to be some songs, but I want to just leave a couple of minutes where there's nothing.